You have a seat. If you have your Bibles, you can open up to Exodus chapter 3. If you grab the blue and white Bible on the floor in front of you, there's a few around. You can open up to page 27, Genesis, Exodus. Exodus is the second book in the Bible. You can go to Exodus chapter 3. We're going to talk today about my favorite story in the Old Testament, the story of Moses. We're talking about fear. I'm sure it's a story that every single one of us here this morning can identify with. Well, the other day I was listening to the radio. Normally I'm listening to Christian radio, but this particular day I wasn't listening to Christian radio. I switched the station and I was listening to a song. And it was a very popular song, and I found myself bopping my head to the beat of this song and singing along with this song. And I had one of those moments that maybe you have too, where you're not really thinking about what you're saying or you're singing, and all of a sudden you have this like moment where you're like, did I just say that? Did that person in that song just say that too? Like that, I got nothing. I have never felt like that. I've never experienced that. They say that music is when you hear a song that you love, it's because the music is already inside. You've already experienced it, and this song has given expression to it, and it's put some tangible teeth into your experience. But this one song, this one line that I heard, I just gone, what? I can't identify with that. I can't understand what this guy's talking about. I've never come to a point in my life where I've ever said this, but I was singing along. And here was the sentence. I can't feel my face when I'm with you, and I love it. Maybe you've heard that song on the radio. It's actually, 2 years ago, it was like top of the charts. It's won Grammy Awards. I mean, it is up there. It's still on the radio. You still hear it in stores. But I have never come to a point in my life where I've ever uttered those words. I can't feel my face when I'm with you, and I love it. I mean, I started thinking, is this guy at the dentist? You know, has he got like this numb face? And but I can't say anyone would love that experience. Not many people I know love the dentist. Maybe he's outside in January in Alberta, and he can't feel his face. But still, I can't say anyone would love that as well. I mean, I've been married for 18 years. Maybe this guy is talking to his wife or his girlfriend. I have never said that. Like, you know, in a Valentine's card, roses are red, violets are blue. I can't feel my face when I'm with you. It just doesn't seem to really hit home with my wife or with me. I've never experienced that song. I get it. I guess I did a little research this week. It has to do with drug use, and that's a whole new discussion in itself, but there's a drug that you take, and I guess you can't feel it. Anyway, another discussion. But then the very next song, I found myself doing the exact same thing. It was one of like really like a dance song, and I was like right into it, and then I was singing this one line, and it went like this. Yeah, 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 I keep on hoping I'll eat cake by the ocean. Now, I'm an East Coast boy. I grew up going to the ocean all the time, my growing up life, like probably once a week. And I've never stared out into the majestic blue ocean and thought, I need some cake. What I need right now is like some cake, frosting, some spring. Like, I've never had that experience. The very next line in the song I thought was very fitting. Let's lose our minds and go crazy, crazy. I thought that's fitting. But there's some songs, there's some stories that you can hear and you don't identify with them at all. You're like, I'm sorry, I got nothing there. But there's also some songs that we hear or some stories that we hear, and it really hits close to home. There's this lump that forms in your throat. Who here cannot identify with this band named Coldplay? And a couple years ago at the Super Bowl, they sang this song, "Tears stream down your face when you lose something you can't replace." I mean, who can't identify with that? You just go to a place in your life, right? Immediately. Or Paul Brandt, this good Saskatchewan boy. I think he's from Saskatchewan. Small towns and big dreams. The best things around that I've ever seen came from small towns and big dreams. Oof. That's where I come from. That's who I am. Hard working, then God bless, yes, sir, thank you, ma'am. Like, that's just right there with a lot of rural Canadians. And to take that a step further, he even sang this at the Humboldt Broncos season opener this past week. The Humboldt Broncos had that big tragedy back in April where they lost most of their team in that bus accident, and he sang that song. The best things I've ever seen came from small towns and big dreams. There's songs that we can identify with, and there's some songs that we just can't. Likewise, there's some stories in the music experiences that we can't identify with, and there's some that we can. Well, today we are going to talk about a story that every single one of us in here can identify with, and I certainly can. It's a story of Moses. And I love studying Moses. I love studying his whole life and his leadership career. There's just so much in there. But there's this one particular aspect in Moses' life that I can solely identify with, and it's Moses at the burning bush. And the overwhelming fear that he has in the face of the situation that God has placed him in. We've all felt it, fear. Maybe for you, it was when you held your newborn baby and you thought, where's the owner's manual to this thing? Am I in charge? Like, where's the adults here? And then that toddler grows up and you start looking at the world around that they're going to have to enter, and you're trying to parent this child, and you walk into their bedroom at night and you're overcome with fear because you don't want to mess this up. You see that baby grow up, and then they leave home, and then this fear grips your heart as well. Have I taught them enough? Maybe for you, it was when you started a new job and you entered into that experience. You're thinking, I just don't want to fail. Maybe it was when you move to a new community and you have this fear of will people accept me? Or maybe you've had someone that you trust turned on you. And laying in your bed at night, staring at the ceiling, you ask this question, who can I trust now? Where we've all looked in our bank account at times in our life and we've thought, how am I going to break even now? Or the news from the doctor. And you sit in a room in the dark, staring out the window, and you wonder, what next? Fear. It can overwhelm us sometimes. Well, how do we get through that? Moses felt some overwhelming fear too in the situation that God had placed him in, as we're going to see this morning when he's in front of this burning bush. And just to give you some background to Exodus chapter 3, as we talk about this story, Moses, he had a bit of a convoluted childhood by all means. He was born into a rather hostile environment. Just to back up and give you some history here, the people of Israel had come into Egypt at the end of Genesis, and they came there because there was a famine. It was Jacob's sons and their families. There was a famine in Israel, and they came into Egypt, and they established themselves in this place called Goshen, and they grew rapidly. I mean, they multiplied like rabbits. There must have been something in the water. But they just kept growing and growing and growing. And it made Pharaoh extremely nervous. And so what does he do? He enslaves them. He gets them to do all their hard labor, treats them like slaves. But that doesn't stop it in anymore. They keep growing and growing and growing. And then so Pharaoh, he puts out this edict that all of the male-born babies are to be thrown into the Nile River. He's trying to stop their population. And so Moses is born into this hostile environment. No matter where you look at history, that's an extremely hostile environment when the leader is going to kill the newborn baby boys. There's genocide. And Moses, it says, parents in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 2, they couldn't hide him for about 3 months. And then in this act of faith and in the sovereignty of God, if you've been to Sunday school, you know the story. They place him in this basket and they place him on the Nile River where they were supposed to throw him to kill him. And they're just like, okay, God, you know, he's yours. And in the sovereignty of God, this basket floats into the princess of Egypt. She takes this child, she realizes it's an Israelite slave's child, takes this and raises it as her own. And in this amazing sovereignty of God moment, she says, well, I need someone to nurse this baby. Go find a mother that has her milk. And they find this mother who is actually Moses' mother. And Moses gets to nurse her baby boy and raises it until he's not nursed any, he doesn't need it anymore. And he goes and lives as a prince in Egypt. He's an Israelite. And his fellow Israelites are slaves, like being whipped and beaten until they build all these buildings. And he is living in luxury. That's going to mess with your head. I mean, he grew up with this identity crisis, I'm sure. And one day, Moses sees an Egyptian beating one of his Israelite friends. And he reacts, probably out of a sense of obligation, like, I'm the only one that can do something. I'm the only one with power. I don't know. I'm supposed to maybe do something. And he reacts, and he kills an Egyptian. And he buries the body in the sand, and he thinks no one has heard about it. A couple days later, he comes out, and he sees two of his fellow Israelites arguing and fighting. And he says, wait a minute, stop. You got bigger fish to fry. Don't fight with each other. And then came this stinging phrase from one of his Israelite friends or Israelite kinsmen that played itself over and over again in Moses' leadership career. Who made you ruler over us? Are you going to kill me like you killed the Egyptian? And Moses panics. And he realizes that the rumor train is getting around and people have found out that he's killed this Egyptian, and he runs like a fugitive and he goes into the wilderness to this place called Midian. He finds a wife and he finds a career as a shepherd, and he's there for 40 years. And then all of a sudden, one day he's out tending sheep and he experiences this theophany. Which is a theophany is when God shows himself to a human being in the Bible, very few times. And he shows himself to Moses through this bush that burns but isn't consumed with fire. It doesn't burn up. It's still perfectly fine, but yet it's on fire. It's this weird parallel dynamic, which we'll talk about in a minute here. And God says to Moses, I have seen my people Israel, who have grown to about 2 million people now, and they're in slavery, and I want you to go to Pharaoh, and I want you to get them out of Egypt and bring you up this mountain, Mount Sinai, where they are now, where he eventually gave them the Ten Commandments, and we're going to worship here, and we're going to take you into the Promised Land. And it's at that moment that Moses becomes overwhelmed with fear. In Exodus chapter 3, let's listen to this dialogue between God and Moses and the four different fears that Moses has in all of this. Exodus chapter 3, verse number 4, follow me on the screen or in your Bible. It says, when the Lord saw that he had gone over, God called to him from within the bush. Moses, Moses. Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy ground. And then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. Next few verses, he basically says, I'm going to send you to Egypt, to Pharaoh. I'm going to control Pharaoh, but go. Verse 10. So now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? This is his first fear. And God said, I will be with you. And this will be a sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. And Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask me, what is your name? What's his name? What shall I tell them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. And God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name you are to call me from generation to generation. And he goes on there from 16 to the end of the chapter. I'm going to be with you. In chapter 4, verse 1, it says this. But Moses answered, but what if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, the Lord did not appear to you? Then the Lord said to him, what's in your hand? A staff, he replied. And the Lord said, throw it on the ground. And Moses threw it on the ground. It became a snake and he ran from it. And then the Lord said to him, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. So Moses reached out and took hold of the snake and it turned back into a staff in his hand. And this, said the Lord, is so that the people may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, Abraham, God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. Then the Lord said to put your hand inside your cloak. So Moses put his hand in his cloak, and when he took it out, the skin was leprous, and it became white as snow. Now put it back in your cloak, he said. So Moses put his hand back in his cloak, and when he took it out, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. Then the Lord said, if they do not believe or pay attention to the first sign, they may believe the second. But they do not believe these two signs or listen to you. Take some water from the Nile, pour it on dry ground, and the water you take from the river will become blood on the ground. We're going to talk about those three signs and what that meant. Verse 10, Moses said to the Lord, pardon your servant, Lord. I've never been eloquent, neither in the past, nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue. The Lord said, who gave human beings their mouths? Who makes them deaf or mute? Who gives them sight or makes them blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, and I will help you speak and tell you, teach you what to say. And then he goes on to say there that, fine, just take your brother Aaron and go and take your staff with you. Fear. It can immobilize us sometimes. And Moses has four specific fears here regarding the situation that God has placed him in. Who am I to do that? God, what's your name? Well, I don't know enough about you, God. What? Tell me something about you. This something in life doesn't make sense right now. And people won't take me seriously. And what if I have to speak in public? And he's overwhelmed by fear. How many of you have ever heard of the NHL player named John Scott? He's a good Edmonton boy, actually. John Scott. He played about 10 seasons in the NHL. And in 2016, he found himself caught up in this experience that he never planned or orchestrated. In 2016, he was actually played in the All-Star game in the NHL. Now, at the time, and the fears leading up to this, the All-Star game had become a bit of a joke, a bit of a gong show for all the fans. It was just plummeting in popularity. Nobody wanted to watch it. It was a bunch of All-Stars not shining like stars. They kind of played half-hearted out in the ice, and it was just a boring game. And so they tried to do things to spark some interest in the game. And one of the things that they did was that they allowed a few spots on the All-Star team, All-Star game, to be selected by the public, you. You could vote to put someone into the All-Star game, anyone in the NHL. And the NHL thought, okay, they're going to choose some, you know, someone maybe that we haven't thought of before with all of your Crosby and Ovechkins and your McDavids and your big All-Stars, right? Well, I think it was out of an act of rebellion because the All-Star game had become kind of a gong show. Someone decided that what they were going to do was they were going to find this individual who was this below-par player, and they did the social media blitz, and they got everyone to vote for this guy named John Scott. He's from Edmonton. John Scott is this below-average player. He's been up and down from the minors for 10 years. He's only scored 5 goals in his career. And the time that he was elected to go into the All-Star game, he only had 1 assist that season. And he had been on the disabled list for part of that year. He was named captain of the Pacific team. He was given the MVP of the game. He scored 2 goals in the game. His helmet was selected for the Hockey Hall of Fame, and it is there now. And they are currently making a movie about this guy right now as we speak. And for reasons that he never manufactured, he finds himself thrust into the limelight, and he's this nobody. And the NHL actually called him and they asked him to kind of withdraw his name. And he was like, no way. I'm not giving up this opportunity. I don't care if the Some weird circumstances has created it. I don't care if there's a, if this is because people are kind of maybe mocking me. I am going to play in that game. And he did. He did. He embraced the moment. Moses does not. He does the exact opposite. All throughout this discourse, God says a number of times, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And I'm sure every time Moses heard that, he kind of cringed. These are these super all-stars, these super heavyweight men of faith that God used in powerful ways in Israel's history. And he's like, you're putting me in the same sentence as those guys? I'm a shepherd. I'm a fugitive shepherd. You're putting me in the same locker room of Crosby and Ovechkin and McDavid? I don't think so. In fact, there's this other interesting thing, this key fact about the Egyptians. In the end of Genesis, when Joseph is in Egypt and all of his 11 brothers are bringing their families to live in Goshen in Egypt because of the famine that they were experiencing in Israel, he tells them this, and it's interesting. When Pharaoh calls you in and asks, what is your occupation? You should answer, your servants have tended livestock from our boyhood on. So speak in broad categories, just as our fathers did. Then you will be allowed to settle in the region of Goshen, for all shepherds are detestable to Egyptians. So when you go in and talk to this superpower world leader of the day, just kind of speak in broad categories. I'm a farmer. I don't tell exactly what you farm. Don't just say you deal with livestock. Don't say that you actually deal with shepherds, with sheep, because Egyptians absolutely think shepherds are the lowest of the low. And this is where Moses is. And Moses knows this. He grew up in that culture. I love that in the Bible, God always stacks the odds against himself. He chooses the nobodies from nowhere to do great things for him. And if I were to rewrite Paul Brand's song, I would say, God chooses the small things to be part of his great big dreams. That's the story over and over and over in the Bible. Moses is this fugitive shepherd runaway, and he's made two enemies in Egypt, the Egyptians and the Hebrews. Now, it is no wonder that he has this first fear, like, who am I? In verse number 11, who am I that I should go before Pharaoh. Now we forget how ridiculous this would be. Pharaoh was this world superpower of the day. He believed that he was God, and he was already known to kill people who threatened his power. Like, he killed those baby boys because the nation was starting to grow. I had this, when I was youth pastor for 8 years in Moncton, I had this kid in my youth group. He was from South Korea. His name is David Lim, and I'll never forget that when all the other kids were talking about movies and video games and relationships and things like that, he was wanting to talk world politics, you know, big subject, like what's going on in the world. And one of the things that really concerned him, because he grew up in South Korea, was the leadership dynamic that was happening in North Korea. And at the time, I think it was Kim Jong-un, I don't know if I pronounced that right, and there was talk of Kim Jong-il, who's the current guy now, and he was maybe going to come into power, and that bothered him so much, because he would tell me these stories about how when you're in this nation, the poor stay poor. If you cross this leader, you die. They play thought police. If they find out anything about your family that has crossed the government, they punish the whole family. I mean, it is like oppression. And we know now more now of it, but at the time, we didn't know a whole lot about this. But he was always talking to me about this. Now imagine with me for a moment. And we forget how ridiculous it is that Moses go to Pharaoh. Imagine with me for a moment, you're walking along the trail back by the river and behind the church here, and you come across a burning bush, and it's God, and he speaks to you, and he says this, I want you to go to the leader of North Korea, and I want you to ask him to give up some of his power. And Moses is like, I have a stick. A staff. That's literally. He has a staff in his hand. which ironically becomes this metaphor for his life. If you read the rest of the book of Exodus, God's like, take your staff, take your staff, take your staff. Even at the Red Sea, take your staff. And that becomes a metaphor for Moses' life, this common, ordinary, insignificant thing that God uses to do extraordinary things in his life. And contrary to what Hollywood might tell us about what went on in this story, and Hollywood makes me cringe and weep and gnash my teeth sometimes because they tried to recreate this story, called it Exodus, Kings and Kingdoms, and they made Moses out to be the self-confident lone ranger who went into Israel and built up this militia to fight off the Egyptians. And oh yeah, God sprinkled a little bit of help in there too, but Moses did it all, and that's not the story at all. He had a stick. Not a militia. He didn't raise up any army. And the response to God, to his fear of who am I to go to Pharaoh, is in verse number 12. He says, I will be with you. Moses, I'm going to be with you. In fact, 14 times all throughout this passage, through these two chapters, God promises this. We sang the song, Fear is a Liar. I'm sure we all can connect with that song. But the biggest lie that fear tells us is that you are by yourself in this situation. That no matter what you're facing, if it's a financial difficulty, if it's a relational fear, if it's this temptation, that you're all by yourself. And nothing could be farther from the truth. I remember when we went to Briarcrest the second time. We had a family. I was 8 years as youth pastor in Moncton, New Brunswick, and God said, I want you to take all that, pack it in a U-Haul, and go do your master's. Do your Master of Divinity at Briarcrest. You did your college there. I want you to do your seminary there now. And I wrestled with God, and I said, with all my heart, no. I was like Moses right here. I was like, what about this, and what about this? If you've done the math, you're not very good at math, God. Like, this ain't going to work. And what about my family? And God says, no, go. And I remember coming to this point in my heart, and I said, okay, we'll go. And I remember going over to an elder in our church whom I look up to and respect. And I remember telling him this story, and I told him, I think I am leaving, and here's what God is doing. And I looked at him, and I said, I'm terrified. And I'll never forget his response. He said, terrified? You don't have to be terrified. The Lord is with you. It was a simple yet profound thing that we often forget in the face of fear. That God is with us. The biggest lie out there is that we are by ourselves. That God just says, well, I don't know, just do it. Figure it out yourself. He is with us. Jesus' famous last words, the last word that the Son of God uttered in the flesh before he went up to heaven and says, I'm coming back again someday. He said this, and lo, I will be with you always, even to the ends of the earth. See, God is with us even now in the New Testament times, beyond New Testament times, in a way that Moses could not have imagined. He is Emmanuel, God with us. Wow. But that doesn't convince Moses. And he has another fear in verse number 13. He says this, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. And they ask, what's his name? What shall I tell them? Now, the name of God was already known in the Old Testament. They knew the name of Yahweh. If we go back into Genesis, we see that the name of Yahweh, God's name, was known by the people. So Moses wasn't asking to hear God's name for the first time. Moses was particularly asking, what does your name mean in circumstances like this? Names were very significant in the Bible. God would often name someone something in conjunction with the work that he was doing in the world. Jesus means God saves. Isaiah means God saves. Hosea was to name his child Ichabod, the glory of the Lord has departed. When God would change the direction of someone's life and he'd get a hold of their life and change it dramatically, he often changed their name. Abram, he changed to Abraham. Sarai, he changed to Sarah. Jacob, he changed to Israel, which means wrestled with God. In the New Testament, we have Saul, who's changed to Paul. When God changed the direction of her life, he changed their name. So names are significant. And so Moses is asking God, what does your name mean in circumstances like this, where for 400 years we haven't heard from you? You've been silent. And God's response, he says this, I am. I am who I am. And at first blush, it may seem like God forgot to finish the sentence or his mic cut out and you missed a word there. Like, I am Brent. What's your name? I am. I just am. But it shows us something very essential about the character of God. That he's this self-existing one, not dependent upon anyone else. He just is. He's the beginning and the end. He is eternal and infinite. And right in front of Moses is this visual illustration about this great I am, this burning bush, this bush that burns but isn't consumed by fire. Now, I don't know if you've seen a fire before, but it burns stuff and it goes to nothing. But this fire didn't burn the bush. Like I said, I went to Briarcrest Bible College in Saskatchewan, went there for college, and one of the interesting facts about Briarcrest, it's not in the town of Briarcrest, Saskatchewan. The town of Briarcrest, Saskatchewan is just south of Regina by a couple hours or so. But after World War II, the government was selling off these military bases. It's in Carenport now, just west of Moose Jaw. And Carenport was this military training base for pilots. And after the war, the government was like basically giving these things away. And so this Bible college latched onto this. It's like, perfect. It's got barracks. It's got all these hangars we can turn into gyms. It's got classrooms. It's got meeting places. It's a perfect place for a Bible school. So they bought it for dirt cheap, and they moved the school there. Still called it Briarcrest. But one of the things, they still had a lot of the old buildings there when I went there in college, and a lot of them have been replaced since then. But one of the things that they did when they built this military base there was they made these buildings extremely flammable so that if they had to abandon the base in a time of war, they say, well, we're not getting it. The enemy's not getting it. And they just light a match and it just whoo. And actually, Keith told me in between the services that they used to coat the poles of these while they were building them with magnesium. I didn't know that. And they would put paper and sawdust in the walls for insulation. This is a tinderbox, just ready to go. And so they tell you this when you move into these places. They say, if it starts a fire, get out. Get out fast, okay? And so one of these buildings was condemned, and they just couldn't fix it up anymore. And so they decided they were going to burn it down. They brought the fire department out there. And I remember coming out of the library one night, and I see this glow in the other side of the town, and I go like everyone else to it, and there's like hundreds of people there watching this thing burn. And in a matter of minutes, I mean, this is just this super hot fire, just whoo, and within a half hour, that building was just done. Nothing. Crazy. Fire burns stuff. It consumes stuff. In fact, we need fire to live. We have to accumulate all kinds of natural resources, keep putting fuel, liquid, wood on our fire to keep us alive. God doesn't need natural resources to live. He has a fuel resource beyond this world. And that's what God is telling Moses, that I have inexhaustible resources, but beyond what you could touch, beyond what you could feel, beyond what you can comprehend, that's not of this world. You just have to accumulate your own resources. I got a limitless supply of it. And it's this illustration for Moses as well, as Moses is going to become this burning bush to Pharaoh, this common thing, this average normal bush that's going to have this supernatural fire, this unexplainable, unconsumable fire within. Fear is a liar. Fear says that the God behind it all is only slightly bigger, slightly smarter, and a slightly better version of me. He's eternal. He has inexhaustible resources available to him. But that's not good enough for Moses, his name. Moses has another fear. In chapter 4, verse 1, he says, "But what if they don't believe me or listen to what I say? People aren't going to take me seriously. Who's going to take me seriously? I mean, and then I think this hit the closest for Moses, the closest home for Moses. He has two enemies in Egypt, the Egyptians and the Israelites, and he didn't leave either on good terms. Rumors. What are people going to think? That is another big fear we have that totally immobilizes us. What are people going to think if I do that? Or what are people going to think? And we believe that everyone's talking. In the midst of some counseling, sometimes that's some of the biggest hurdles that I got to get past. No, these perceived rumors are nowhere near what you're believing they are. Those that can get past them are can blossom and flourish. But if you live with these perceived rumors of what people are thinking, you'll never do anything for God. Be crippled by fear. And God's response is he gives Moses the supernatural ability to perform signs. The staff to snake, the leprous hand, and the Nile River to blood. Now, God gave prophets in the Bible these abilities to perform signs. And it wasn't some of this like street magic David Blaine for like people going, ooh, wow. These were specific illustrations for the people. And anyone who would saw these things would have been wowed at what God was doing through Moses. The staff to the snake. The snake was a big part of Egyptian religion. And in fact, if you look on the Pharaoh's headdress in those days, it had a snake on it. And so putting the staff on the ground, it becomes a snake, and Moses takes it by the tail and it becomes a staff again. Anyone of the Israelites who would have saw that would have been had a clear picture that God had given Moses the ability to control Pharaoh. The leprous hand that went in his, or the hand went in his cloak, became a leprosy and then went back in and restored, would show the people that God had given Moses the ability to give and restore life, which he does. And then the Nile River taken and poured on the ground and it becomes blood would have been a very, I guess, emotional illustration for the people where they would have seen that God had seen the blood spilled by Pharaoh when he threw all the male-born babies into the Nile River. Fear is a liar. It says people and God will not accept us. That he has no use for us because of our past. Nothing could be further from the truth. But Moses has one more fear here. Chapter 4, verse number 10. He says, I don't want to speak in public. The literal translation is, I am dull of mouth and speech. This is the number one fear of most people. Not a fear of dying is number one on the list, and the fear of public speaking is second. I think Jerry Seinfeld said it best where he said, most people would rather be the subject of a funeral rather than speak at one. Moses is like, I stutter, I fight to get the words out. I spend my time yelling at sheep. I don't spend my time crafting speeches for diplomats. I'm going into the dragon's den here and I got to get this pitch just right. And God's response is, who made language? Who gave you lips? Who gave you a tongue? I will teach you what to say. And then he says, take Aaron later on. And it's interesting that if you read the rest of the story, Aaron does very little of the talking and Moses does most of the talking. Fear is a liar. It tells you that God is not enough. That he's going to place you in a situation where it's beyond you your ability to handle the situation, and nothing could be farther from the truth. Who am I? What's your name? I don't know enough about you, God. People aren't going to take me seriously. And what if I have to speak in public? Fear. In Nova Scotia, where I grew up, they have this little zoo there. It's called Oaklawn Farm Zoo. And believe it or not, a few years ago, Believe it or not, it had the largest lion in captivity in the world. It died just a few years ago. But at the time, it was the largest lion in captivity in the world. And they say that lions are larger in captivity than they are in the wild because they eat so well. And so I remember growing up and going to see this lion at this zoo. And it's this little nothing zoo in rural Nova Scotia, like 20 minutes from where I grew up. I used to go there every summer. And this largest lion in captivity in the world is 836 pounds of King of the Jungle beast. That's huge. That's like bigger than that piano there. It was absolutely massive, this lion. And this zoo is actually pretty impressive for being in the middle of nowhere, and it only charges like $5 or $6 to get in. I mean, they had animals from all over the world at this place. And people used to go there and hang out with all the animals. But my favorite thing to do was to get as close as I could to the lion's cage. They had a massive cage, probably half the size of this property, and this mountain in the middle. And they had probably a dozen lions in there. All throughout the day, they were kind of docile. But at night, they got a little bit more active in evening time. And that was the most popular time to actually go see them because that was feeding time. And they could sense it and they could smell it. And I would try to get as close as I could to a lion. They were in this double fenced-in cage, and they had this massive fence, and then about 15 feet, and then another fence that you had to stand behind. Here, I just love to try and get as close as I can to be in the presence of something so powerful. I mean, this lion just gazed at you as it's pacing back and forth, looking at you, knowing full well if that fence wasn't there, you'd be its next lunch. I don't know if you've ever heard a lion purr. It will make your knees quake. And so the most popular time to come was feeding time. And the owner there would explain what she's doing as everyone's kind of gathered around to watch. And she would push in this wheelbarrow into the cage. And she would explain what was going to happen. She goes, "You watch. I'm going to put this wheelbarrow full of meat from like roadkill that the Department of Highways had brought in from some deer or whatever, and then I'm going to put this in there, and you watch what happens. None of the lions will touch a piece of meat until Rutledge has chosen his piece." And she puts it in, and sure, at the back, Rutledge just stands right up on this mountain, and he makes his kingly walk towards his big wheelbarrow of meat. He licks all the pieces. He selects his piece. And then all of these lions just devour this wheelbarrow of meat. I don't know if you've ever heard a lion roar. I have friends who live 4 kilometers away from that zoo. And they say that they hear feeding time every single night. When a lion roars, it will shake every bone in your body. And Moses stands in the presence of Almighty God. And he knows his name. And if his name is I Am, Moses must feel in that moment that I am not. And that's an important thing because he's going to Pharaoh who thinks he is God. Moses, are you going to really take these people out of Egypt? I am not. Are you really going to send these plagues? I am not, but I am. He's got something coming for you. You see, the antidote to our fear is embracing the name of God in your inner being. I heard Louis Giglio do a talk on this whole passage, and I love how he summarized Moses' posture in all of this. I am not, but I know I am. It's a play on words. It's not just the power of positive thinking there, but he's basically saying, I am not. I am not sufficient in myself to do this. This isn't about convincing yourself that you can do it. You can't, but with the great I am, you can. I am not. I am not capable in myself to do this, but as I know God's name, the great I am in my inner being, I can. I am not, but I know I am. There's this invincible weakness that comes when we embrace that. How many have ever felt this before? Who could be smart enough to figure this out? I am. If I don't do it, who will? I am. Nobody's listening to me. I am. Who can I trust? I am. Who's going to provide for me? I am. How's my family going to survive this? I am. What will my peers think? I am. Who's going to want me after this? I am. I've given it all, but it's never enough. I am. I can't hold it together anymore. I am. I'm done. I am. I quit. I am. Somebody just hold me. I am. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the Savior. I am the Redeemer. I am the solution. I am the restorer. I'm the builder. I'm the healer. I'm the answer. I'm the provider. I'm the all-present one. I'm the all-powerful one. I'm the all-knowing one. I'm the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I am the good shepherd. I am the living one. I am the true vine. I am the mighty one. I am the wise one. I am the eternal one. I am the Alpha and the Omega. I am the beginning and the end. I am the coming one. I am the Lord. You see, the antidote to our fear is embracing the name of God in our inner being. I am not, but I know I am. I'm going to ask the worship team to come. I talked about some songs that I can't identify with when I hear them, and I've talked about some songs that I can identify with when I hear them, and a lot of songs that I hear on Shine FM, on the Christian radio station, I obviously can identify with. That song gives expression to my experience, and I can identify it. It's already here, and it just gives it some tangible teeth I can seek into. Well, one of the songs that I've heard on the radio, and then we consequently did it at kid camp as well, is a song called I Am. And it goes like this. I am holding on to you. In the middle of the storm, I am holding on to you. And we can take that two different ways. That I am holding on to God, but also the great I am is saying, I'm holding on to you. I don't know what fear you're facing this morning, but rest assured that the great I am is holding on to you.